Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Enough with the bailouts and government-backed buyouts already. Nobody's buying the drip, drip, drip solution to what ails Wall Street, and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson knows it. And that probably explains the news today that he is working on a long-term answer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. Marketplace entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income, supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 18th of September. Good to have you here. The Secretary of the Treasury seems to have come to the same conclusion the markets have, that trying to tiptoe his way through the minefield that is Wall Street these days just is not going to work. There are reports this afternoon that Paulson's thinking about going back to something that worked during the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s. Back then, it was called the Resolution Trust Corporation. I don't know what it would be called this time, but it would work almost the same way. Chris Lowe is the chief economist at FTN Financial.
What's being discussed today is something similar, where a fund would be set up by the U.S. government that would go into the marketplace and buy up unwanted mortgage securities and hold them on the sidelines until some of the panic calmed down.
It didn't take but a whisper that Paulson's thinking about a systemic fix and the markets took off. The other thing that bounced investors higher is a bit more technical. The Securities and Exchange Commission toughened its rules on short selling last night. That is, betting a stock price is going to go down. You borrow the stock, you sell it on that bet it's going to go down, and then you can buy it back cheaper and return the borrowed shares. You pocket the difference. Today, the British government banned the shorting of financial firms outright, and New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo launched an investigation into shorting of financial stocks there. We asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, to explain why it matters.
To make a short story, well, short, the free market just got a little less free with this crackdown on short selling. Even those who want to rein in the shorts concede it plays a key role in sniffing out companies in trouble. Mark Kaufelt is president and chief investment officer of Empiric Funds. He says short sellers might well have played a role in AIG's fall from the 20s to around $2 a share in a week. But if the stock really was cheap at that price, he argues, buyers should have rushed in at some point.
If I had confidence that AIG was not near bankruptcy, I would have bought it at $2 a share. So I think the short sellers were right on.
Kaufelt expects the SEC restrictions on short sellers here in the U.S. to have little positive effect. If anything, he's worried that a move to require big investors to reveal their short positions daily could backfire. If, for example, it forces a well-regarded hedge fund manager to show his hand, but only when he's shorting a stock.
And you say, gosh, that's a really smart guy. Then I think you definitely run the risk of pylon.
Kaufelt points out short sellers don't operate in a vacuum. Buyers also move stock prices.
It becomes very difficult to manipulate. There's other people on the other side of the market.
But there's no doubt short selling has gotten hugely popular. ShortSqueeze.com tracked almost 30 billion shares that were sold short in the market late last month. That's a six-fold increase over the last decade. Robert Ellis is senior vice president of wealth management at Celent. He says once short sellers get to work on a stock, the effect for would-be buyers can be as intimidating as jumping in front of a moving train.
A lot of the professional traders I talk with are afraid of going up against the shorts. The rules have been tilted to their advantage. It's so key a part of making money on Wall Street now. Most firms make more money from securities lending, in other words, lending securities to short sellers, than they do on commissions.
He says the irony is, if you're invested in a stock, perhaps through your 401k mutual fund and hoping its value goes up, your fund manager might be lending that stock out to short sellers, and they could be pushing the share value lower. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
What we thought was going to be the day's lead story when we got up this morning has been almost buried by the rush of events today. The U.S. Fed and central banks around the world got together overnight to coordinate their efforts to prop up financial markets. Six central banks, from the U.S. to Japan to Switzerland, added another $180 billion into the global banking system. It's pretty much the same thing they've been doing for the past year and a half, trying to get banks to start lending money again. Now, though, given what's been happening this week, they really want them to open up those purse strings. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The idea is that commercial banks and lenders will use this central bank money to cover their short-term cash needs for things like a big withdrawal or a credit transaction. Most of the time, that kind of everyday activity is done with quick, private, overnight loans between banks. But now there's no confidence such loans will be repaid. Former Federal Reserve staff member David Jones called the coordinated worldwide injection of government cash long overdue.
The key really was that we did have, at long last, all of the major central banks in the world combining in a way that injected cash globally to the markets, hopefully to symbolize that the central banks are there as a backstop to these extremely nervous and unsettled financial markets.
And the signal from this global coordination is that there's more money to come if necessary, says Carl Weinberg with High Frequency Economics.
The solidarity of the central banks in moving forward together on this is a statement to the markets that if this injection is inadequate, all the central banks stand prepared to do whatever is necessary to keep the banking system moving forward.
The Federal Reserve has been making extra lines of credit available to U.S. lenders since last spring, without much benefit to financial confidence. But now that global central banks are working together, Carl Weinberg expects to see quick results.
It could take a few days. I don't think this will drag out for a long period of time, and I'm hoping that the confidence factor will return rather quickly.
Repairing the damage from this financial crisis will take a lot longer, he says. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As I mentioned, success on Wall Street today was spelled RTC. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know those chaotic television shots you see of the floor of the stock exchange, especially on a day like today when things are crazy? There are trading floors like that all over New York, at private companies that trade commodities or bonds or pretty much anything else. And those floors are where a lot of the actual business has been happening this week. We've called Tom DiGaloma to ask what it's been like. He runs the government bond trading desk for Jefferies & Company in New York City. Tom, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
How's your week been so far, Tom?
The week has been pretty hectic. We have seen a tremendous amount of inflows into the U.S. Treasury market.
Do you think that's because they're nervous and they're looking for something that is safe, like Treasuries?
Extremely nervous. I would actually almost call it a panic. We have seen rates dive here in the front end of the Treasury market to a point where we're actually almost at negative yields in T-bills.
Explain what that means to us, Tom.
Negative T-bill rates is actually you're buying a treasury bill that actually you end up paying the government to actually own their treasury bills.
You ever seen that before?
Never saw it. I've been doing this for 23 years, and it's certainly one of these phenomenons that really cannot be explained.
Is there a way you can relate to us how fast things are moving for you guys on these trading desks? I mean, it's moving fast in the regular news. I imagine people are actually making and losing money. It's moving even faster.
The pace of activity that we've seen in the bond trading room has been almost a panic with customers trying to get in and out of trades. Tremendous amounts of money have basically been made and lost in the last few trading days.
Who's winning and who's losing this week? I mean, who's making money, who's not?
I think stock investors obviously are the big losers. I think the big winners have been those who have owned treasury bonds at levels when we sold off after the Bear Stearns collapse back in March. And I think those are the big winners, those who knew that the market was not going to recover in a very early turn. And those are the ones that have actually made out fine this week.
We know the markets are stressed in all kinds of different ways. What about you? I mean, when you get into work in the morning, What's it like?
It's extremely fast-paced environment, that we're all involved in. I can't imagine there's anything quite like it. You know, you're entering the ball game every day, and you're playing it 5 days a week instead of just on Saturdays.
Is this one of those jobs that when you're done at the end of the day, you can go home and leave behind?
No, I think we're pretty much in this for 24 hours a day. I mean, we're at home checking markets and finding out what's going on in Asia, listening to the likes of Bloomberg TV until the wee hours of the evening. And then we get up and do it all over again.
Got to be a better way to make a living, Tom. Tom DiGaloma runs the government bond trading desk for Jefferies & Company in New York City. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So the Dow was up 400-some-odd points today. That's nice. It's reassuring, but quite possibly not the most important economic news of this day or any other day. The Dow Industrial Average consists of just 30 stocks, after all. The roster changes from time to time, and today is one of those times. Dow Jones says come next Monday, it's going to drop AIG, the big insurance company that Washington just bailed out. AIG is gone. Kraft Foods is in. That's right, the company that touts the fact that it's the cheesiest. So back to my original point. If the most popular market indicator can swap out a huge international insurance company, net revenues of $110 billion last year, and replace it with a food company that makes about a third of that, how much weight should we really be giving the Dow? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story from New York.
So who makes the decision to get rid of AIG and replace it with Kraft? This guy, for one. Ken Brown, one of the editors of the Wall Street Journal, a Dow Jones publication.
When we looked at what we didn't represent in the index, we saw food companies and consumer goods companies were underrepresented in that sense. We have McDonald's and we have Coke, but nothing like Kraft.
Brown says journal editors want the Dow average to represent the various sectors of the U.S. economy. But Stanford economist John Chauvin says it never will, no matter what they put in it.
Well, it's a very flawed index. It's the worst pretty much of all the stock indices. Its only claim to fame is its extremely long history. It's approaching 120-year history now.
Why is it the worst? Because he says stocks are equally weighted, with no accounting for the size of each company. So one stock's collapse can pull down the entire average. And there are only 30 stocks in the Dow, as compared with the S&P's index of 500 or the 5,000 stocks in the Wilshire. Dan Seaver is a finance professor at San Diego State University. He says the bigger indices are a better gauge of the market, but the Dow definitely wins the popularity contest.
It's a nice shorthand, and people know what you're talking about. You say the market's down 450. Everybody knows you're talking about the Dow average. And if some people started talking about the Wilshire, you know, nobody would pay as much attention. But if you want to say, how is my performance compared to the market? You'd never compare it to the Dow. You'd compare it to the Wilshire.
Just in case you were wondering, both the Dow and the Wilshire are down about 15% for the year. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There's a truism in economics that goes a little something like this. The value of an asset, whether it's a share of stock or a piece of art, is worth what somebody else is willing to pay for it. A lot of the pain on Wall Street this week has been because banks are finally cutting the prices on their assets, and still, potential investors aren't sure the price is low enough. The same kind of freeze-up is happening in housing. Commentator and behavioral economist Dan Ariely says, in a falling market, your house is almost always worth more to you than it is to anybody else.
A recent study conducted by Zillow finds a not-my-house sentiment. What does that mean? Well, despite the evidence that 77% of U.S. homes actually declined in value in the past year, 62% of homeowners believe that the value of their own home has increased or stayed the same. How can that be? I think part of the story has to do with the changes and tinkering we do to our homes. When someone moves into a new house, they often make changes to their home. They break a wall, maybe they change a tile, fix a bathroom, or add a porch. The house is now tailored to its particular owner's unique taste, perfect for that person. There's also our inability to understand that the changes we've made to fit our own individual taste might be ones that others don't see or don't value. So what happens when a homeowner compares their own house to a house that was sold for a lower amount down the street? Simple explanation. That other house was just not nearly as nice. There was something just not quite right about it. Something a little bit off. That must be the reason it didn't sell for more, right? Can we get over our egocentric bias of looking at our own homes from the perspective of our own preferences? I suspect it's very hard. Maybe the only people who can do it are those who are unable or uninspired to remodel their homes. These people are going to be less susceptible to the "not my house" sentiment. They're also going to be more likely to understand that the values of their homes are going down. They might be depressed thinking about it, but they might also be able to make better decisions about their homes.
Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. He is also the author of the book Predictably Irrational. Send us your thoughts, the rational ones only, please. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. Coming up, perfecting product design.
My dream is not to have a style that is recognizable, but I want to have an idea process that is recognizable.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, I think you could say confidence made a comeback today. The Dow Industrial shot up 3.8%, 410 points, closed at 11,019. The NASDAQ added 4.75%, 100 points, ended at 21.99. The S&P 500 put on 50 points, that's 4.75%, finished at 12.06. Checking the much bigger picture, you know, just because Jeremy told us to, the broad-based Wilshire 5000 index was up almost 4.5% today. Bank stocks soared, Citigroup gained more than 18%, Bank of America pulled up more than 12%, Wells Fargo deposited more than 10%, and batter giant Washington Mutual recovered nearly 49% today. The promise of more liquidity in the system drove automakers higher. General Motors revved up nearly 15%. Ford stock shifted higher by 6.8%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. By the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Prime Minister of Kuwait is scheduled to meet with President Bush in Washington. The National Black MBA Association continues its annual conference in Washington. And on September 19, 1957, in Nevada, the U.S. conducted the first nuclear explosion entirely contained underground. The test produced no radioactive fallout. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. No matter how it seems, the global economy isn't really about huge conglomerates and multinational corporations. Strip away all those layers, and what you've got left is a single person doing a job, trying to get by. Our series, Working, is about the lives of individuals in that global economy. Take a good look at almost anything around you, your cell phone, your shoes, your furniture, and you're seeing the collective effort of hundreds, even thousands of people. Many of those objects, though, started with industrial designers, the people who decide just how the things in our lives look and feel. John Miller tracked one down in Milan, Italy.
Raffaella Mangiarotti designs ordinary objects, but always with a twist.
This is a toilet brush.
Like a toilet brush that squirts soap, or
it's a very simple sponge.
A donut-shaped like dish sponge that wraps around the kitchen faucet, or
is a little plunger.
A plunger.
And the little tweezer is inside the plunger, so
with long plastic tweezers nested in the handle to let you pick up objects that might have fallen in the toilet.
And it's a very little idea, but it's very nice.
Mangiarotti has come up with a whole stream of nice little ideas since she co-founded a firm called Deep Design with a friend, Matteo Bazzicalupo, in 1995.
Now, if I can show you, because it's a prototype that is functioning.
We're in her bright white high-rise apartment in Milan, looking at some of their stuff. She and Bazzicalupo have designed dozens of commercial products: a hot plate for KitchenAid, a video camera for JVC,
and so,
and this professional hair dryer built on spec with no company backing. It shuts off automatically when she puts it down.
Take it off. Stop.
Not only that, the weight of the motor is below the hand, which makes it easier on the arms, and it blows air downward, so the hairdresser doesn't have to hold it so high, which is better for the circulation.
We check it with our stylist, and they were very glad to have this kind of innovation. Now we are searching for a producer and distributor, perhaps in America.
Milan is the center of the universe for industrial design, but there's not nearly as much industry here as there used to be, so lots of designers have moved into high-end artsy stuff like jewelry and fancy furniture. But Mangiarotti says she's much more interested in technical innovation than in style.
My dream is not to have a style that is recognizable, but I want to have an idea process that is recognizable.
She says you can see that process in her work, a kind of intellectual DNA, based on the idea that there's no sense designing a product if it doesn't solve a problem.
The project is not an answer, it's a question. When you decide what is the question related to a project, then the shape comes, naturally.
Which sounds pretty abstract for a person whose job is to create things. So I ask her how she'd go about designing, say, an alarm clock.
What could be nice is not really starting from the design of the alarm clock, because the problem is not the shape.
The problem is waking up. She hates to do it, and she figures other people do too. So she'd start by doing research into more natural ways to ease into the day.
And starting from this, we'll design a process and then give a shape to this process.
Whatever the shape, it would not go.
Beep, 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 beep.
But if she couldn't come up with anything better than what's already out there, she says she'd rather design nothing at all. That's because the last thing the world needs is more stuff.
My problem is that I am a designer, because for my work I have to produce idea and I have to produce products. And in this society I would like to not produce anything, because there is too many things.
Not that that's an option at the moment. Mangiarotti's working on all sorts of things. A line of children's products for the American company Graco. A high-tech bed with built-in video and audio. The list goes on. Raffaella Mangiarotti does most of her work on a Macintosh laptop at her dining room table. She also teaches twice a week at the Polytechnic University of Milan. And she spends a lot of her time talking on the phone.
Pronto? Ciao Maurizio.
As she drives between meetings with students and clients and collaborators.
We are arrived. Oh, it was a long way, no?
This morning she's visiting a furniture factory about an hour from the city. She's designing a kitchen for people with disabilities. This is where they're building the prototype.
It's a kitchen for disabled people. But I don't want to do a kitchen that seems for disabled. So there are some secrets revealed by the use of the kitchen.
Secrets like cabinets that swing downward and individually cooled wooden drawers instead of a refrigerator. Mangiarotti says she loves projects like this, where you get to question all your assumptions and start from zero. The one she's most proud of is a complete rethinking of the washing machine for Whirlpool Europe.
When we look at the washing machine, we understood that the most interesting way of washing now is the hand washing. Because when you have something that you care, when you love, you wash by hands.
So she and Batsy Kalupo designed a machine that gently squeezes clothes with an inflatable bladder. The model they built is round and pearly and translucent. It looks more like a futuristic urn than an appliance.
So it's a really new object that can be introduced in a living room. Why not?
The idea won a major award. The object never made it to the market. That's one of the risks of thinking outside the big white box. Mangiarotti is a single mother. Her son Ludovico is 10. This is an open house at his school. It started at 6, but she got caught in meetings and got here a little late. Mangiarotti says she's getting better about separating work and life, but it's not easy. It's not just the classes and the phone calls and the emails and the meetings. It's also learning to disengage her brain. She'll often find herself staring at a tree or a bird, trying to figure out how it does what it does.
When some client comes to me and say, I have a material, I have a technology I want to use, I don't go in the office and I immediately start with this work. I go around the town, I do the things that I have to do, but the project is in my mind. And also in the night, I'm thinking. Sometimes in the morning I say, what I was dreaming this night. It's very difficult for me to say when I'm working and when I'm working not.
Of course, as any industrial designer knows, having no off switch can be a problem. Raffaella Mangiarotti says she's working on it.
John Miller took the rough duty in Milan to get that story for us. Our series Working is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. You can see pictures of some of Raffaella Mangiarotti's products and listen to other working profiles on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, which comes with the realization that you may never again want to hear the words Bill Gates and but in the same sentence. Microsoft has reportedly retired the ads that feature its founder and comedian Jerry Seinfeld. The first one, and sadly the one that I saw, featured the two in a shoe store, somehow trying to tie that into the software company, and ended with a shot of Gates walking away from the camera, shaking his you-know-what. The campaign is said to have cost $300 million. The only thing Microsoft is saying is that it's exploring its options. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 410 points, 3.8%. The NASDAQ rose 100 points, 4.75%. The S&P 500 added 49 points. That's 4.33%. Kevin Arnovitz, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, understanding the brains behind search.
Those who figure out best how to organize their data will pop to the top of all kinds of lists. They'll be the first name you see in online dating. They'll be the first choice for the promotion to the Paris office.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.